Have a specific episode you want to hear? No problem. Head on over to thevap.locals.com. You can listen to any episode, anytime. Stream it directly to your phone or on a computer. You can also pick from one of our many curated playlists to hear specific topics. So head on over to thevap.locals.com.
For Saturday, November 24th, 2008, you're listening to The Vap, episode 58, The 60s.
With 2 tons of aluminum hitched to his bumper, cruising down the internet superhighway, The Vap is streaming right to your ears. Vintage Airstream Podcast. And now your host for the Vintage Airstream Podcast, Tim Shepard.
Living in aluminum.
Here we are back again for episode 58. We have with us Colin Hyde of GSM Vehicles.
Hey, gang. How's everybody doing?
Hey, we got Rob Baker with us as usual.
Hello. Good evening, everybody.
And we have a special guest, Fred Caldwell, the Vintage Airstream Club historian. Welcome, Fred.
Thank you. And
you got a bird there with you?
Yeah. Okay. Leftover turkey.
Gobble, gobble. Yeah, we're coming to you a day late because of Turkey Day. And I think we're lucky to even come to you today the way everybody, or at least my day's been today. Pretty eventful.
Tim, I was just waiting for episode 58 so I could say the best year of the Airstreams.
58 because of your...
58 Sovereign, of course.
Oh, yeah. So next show will be Collins and the one after that will be mine.
That's right.
I have one in every decade.
Yeah. You always got to one-up us, Colin.
There you go.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about the 60s. If everybody recalls, we had a show on the 30s, 40s, and we had another one on the 50s, and we thought we'd cover the 60s in this show. But my family here this past Sunday woke up. We're in Northern California. We woke up and decided, hey, let's go to Disneyland. And just out of the blue, because the kids were out of school and everybody was not sick at the same time for once. So we started booking plans and we looked at hotels and they were going to be $160 a night. And then my brother said, hey, there's a campground there we go to. It's $50 a night. I'm like, towing the trailer to L.A.
In rush hour.
On a holiday. Okay, sounds like fun. So, spur of the moment, trailer side of the house, got it all hooked up, and headed out down through L.A. with the trailer just to save $100 a night. But it was fun. Kids had a good time coming back. My daughter didn't understand how we could go camping in Disneyland at the same time, but it worked out good.
Well, I'm proud of you, Tim. You actually got it on the road.
And spur of the moment. That's not like us. We usually plan every detail.
That's true. That trailer should be doing, going down the road.
It was definitely a full-service place, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. It was a concrete parking lot, right? And they had a little shuttle to take you right to Disneyland. I mean, it was just like a couple miles, and they had a little daily shuttle there. Yeah, just concrete pads, full hookups, and all that stuff. So
it actually just stayed at Walmart.
Yeah. Well, no, we needed a sewer.
We might be doing the same, but on the East Coast, Fort Wilderness in February, Tim. So we'll see. Yeah,
that'd be cool. I've been dreaming of that trip. But driving through L.A. once again, like I said, but on one of the shows before, with all the freeway work and highway interchanges and big rigs and other trailers, it's nice to have good. Good axles and know that you did everything right going down the road and your brakes work and all that stuff. But everything worked out good on the trailer.
Excellent. There's no adventure in that.
I know. It's like, well, another good thing too is having everything work is the young ones had to go back to the trailer early so me and the teenager could stay till closing at Disneyland. And knowing that everything in the trailer was going to work, just flip the switch for the hot water and, you know, everything was going to work fine. I didn't have to worry about the pilot lights burning out or her having a problem with the fridge or not having hot water for the bath. So that was nice, too.
I mean, you didn't have a wheel come off or a trailer tongue come off?
No. No, nothing like that.
Break in half.
Or break in half, that's right.
Anyway, I was kind of worried about towing through L.A. traffic. With all the way people cut you off and all that stuff, you know, having, what do I have? I have like 58 feet between the trailer and the truck.
That means you win.
Yeah. But it wasn't too bad, you know, it wasn't too bad. I did have to push one lady over and she gave me a funny wave, but it worked out. So
what I find the best way is you just twitch the steering wheel a little bit so you get into a bit of a zing, then everybody gets out of your way, then you can pull right over.
Oh. That's good. That works.
Yeah.
Your own little sway control, right, Colin?
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Anyway, that was our little adventure. One day for driving for each day at Disneyland. So it was a long drive, though. Long drive pulling a trailer.
It's a longer one for us.
Yeah, I bet it is. But it worked out. Everybody had a good time. Anyway, let's get on with the 60s era. I don't know. What should we start?
1960?
Well, I think our last show, even though yours is a 60, Tim, we left off with yours because it was made in 59. So, you know, if I remember correctly. But, yeah, we get right into the 60s and up through to when they changed later on in the decade.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I was noting on mine, I was telling my wife, one of the good things about my year, the 1960, is that a lot of the components that make it up are simple hardware store items. You know, like the windows, if you need it, the window breaks, you can go spend $20, have a new window cut. You can get the bedding tape to put it back on. You can get latches. You can get cranks. You can get all kinds of stuff. It's just regular hardware store stuff. You don't have to go and find anything weird for a majority of it, and like the cabinets and latches and all this kind of stuff. So it makes it nice.
Yeah, well, that is a good point. 60 was the last year for leaf springs on the trailer. And starting in 61, they went to the DuraTorque axles. And then they improved the interiors throughout the 60s and used more specialized hardware that is more difficult to find. So they're nicer interiors, but it's a little bit more of a challenge to get all the correct hardware and parts as the years progress through the 60s.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. You have a curved window or, you know, special molded sinks and stuff instead of just like a regular stainless steel sink you can put into a countertop if you wanted to redo it. It makes it easier for those earlier years. But we're talking about the later years, so what other kind of amenity changes in the 60s decade occurred?
Well, as a quick overview before we get into details, Wally Byam died on July 22nd, 1962. And he was in the hospital and ill the year before that. So during the 60s, you began to see a lot of influence of Art Costello, who ran the California factory. And he steps forward. He was elected president in 63. And so he sort of takes over and guides the trailers of the 60s with his vision of what a trailer should look like. And they tend to be a little more luxurious and sophisticated than the Airstreams during Wally's reign, which were more function-oriented as opposed to more style and not quite fashion, but a little more stylish when Art took over.
So, we also had, Fred, in the 60s, didn't we have the going from the West Coast and East Coast competition, dual factories back to just one?
Yes. Each year there was more and more standardization between the two factories. I just came across an interesting study of 1962 Airstreams by the factory engineering department between California and Ohio. And they list a whole bunch of differences, a lot of things that people aren't aware of. For example, the width of the frame may vary between the two factories by 3/4 of an inch. And so if you're doing axles, replacing axles on trailers in the early 60s, at least, be careful in measuring the frames, because the Ohio frames are going to be a different width than the California frames.
In fairness, the Ohio frames were also different from other Ohio frames.
Yes. And so, yeah, they recognized they had a problem with a lack of standardization, and there's just reading a letter from Wally to the two factory heads, Andy Charles in Ohio and Art Costello in California, saying customers are beginning to complain about the differences in the trailers between the factories, and we have to standardize. So the East Coast people don't have to go to California to get a particular model and vice versa. So the 60s, they kept narrowing the differences each year between the two trailers in both visible and hidden features.
When did the California plant come into being? Was it in the 60s?
It was 50.
Yeah, in the 50s. Probably like 55, somewhere around there.
Oh, okay. So they had a long time of non-standardization between the two then.
Oh, yeah. Well, they started in California in 47, but the Norwalk, California plant came online, maybe in the mid-50s. And they closed the 1755 North Main Street, so built things in Norwalk, which was incorporated into Santa Fe Springs in 58. And so that was the same plant all the way through the 60s. But one of the biggest improvements began in 61 when they went from leaf spring to the DuraTorque axle. And that it provided a nicer ride because each wheel could respond independently from the other to road conditions.
Was that one of the big takeaways from the Cape Town to Cairo trip back in 59?
Yes, it was. They tested the DuraTorques for 5 years on some of Wally's trailers before bringing them online. And so that was, and they had it on the Cape Town to Cairo on his gold trailer. And he had a lot fewer problems with that than leaf springs, which, some of them broke on the trail. So they decided to go ahead and standardize those in 61. I understand the first year they welded them into the frames, and in 62 on they bolted them in.
Actually, you're right, they did weld them on, but we've also found a couple where they were actually bolted on, but the mounting plate actually extended up beyond the chassis and bolted through the side of the chassis, so you had to actually get into the belly pan to access the bolts.
Oh, okay. So they welded them to the mounting plates and bolted the mounting plates to the frame.
Well, it depended. On this particular Tradewind, we found it like that, but all of the Bambis, we found the whole axle, plates, everything was welded right to the chassis. So okay. they were going through a few different ideas on how to attach these axles to the trailer, all in 1961.
Colin, can you give a brief comparison or description between the leaf spring and DuraTorque for people who don't know?
Well, the leaf spring is your traditional sort of trailer axle, where it's a solid axle. Typically, they were a 4-inch drop, I believe, which basically the wheel center was 4 inches offset from the axle center, and it had leaf springs that suspended the axle from the suspension. The DuraTorque has a torsion axle, which has a square tube that's basically bolted directly to the chassis through brackets, etc. And there's these rubber rods that go inside the square tube, and there's another square bar that's mounted at 45 degrees to the tube, and the on the end of the square bar is a torsion arm, and then on the end of that torsion arm is a spindle which the wheel mounts on. And as the wheel goes up and down, this basically it's like a crank. It's goes inside the square tube, and it actually crushes these little rubber rods, and it's using the rubber the durometer of the rubber as the spring itself. And depending on the length of the rod determines the load capacity of the axle. So that's basically the difference. I think they had advertisements, Fred, you can correct me on this, but I think in a leaf spring axle is like 100 and some odd parts, and with the DuraTorque it was, you know, 10 or 15 parts or something. So it was,
yeah, I think they advertised like 146 fewer parts on the DuraTorque axle than on a leaf spring.
Yeah.
So
those, big difference.
Those fewer parts is what makes it not break down so much when they were doing that caravan that Rob was talking about?
Yeah, it was much more bulletproof and reliable.
Yeah, because I guess that's why they had to come up with something different, because they had a lot of leaf springs breaking or something during those overseas caravans.
Yeah, well, they're really abusing the leaf springs. About the only consistent problem with the DuraTorx or on the smallest trailers with the 5-bolt hubs, they tend to snap the spindles from the early years, mostly the Bambis. But once you reach the mid-50s, they've corrected mid-60s. That problem. Or mid-60s, they corrected that problem.
Yeah. We found on those lighter ones, caravels are breaking as well.
Okay.
Yeah. So does anybody know how that came about? Did Airstream push for a better design, or was that just something that Henschen came up with?
As far as I know, that axle design is a German design.
Oh, okay. So, well, who supplied the leaf spring axles at that time before they switched?
Oh, it would depend on the factory. You know, Hadco, they used a lot from L.A. and another brand, forget which, from Ohio.
Okay, so the Henschens was really the DuraTorx then?
Yes.
Yeah. We have seen differences in leaf spring axles and drops and backing plates and even quantity of studs, quite frankly. Everybody's familiar with the sort of the larger trailers with 6 studs, but some of the earlier trailers had 5 studs, even though they may have been 22, 23, 25 foot long.
So the 6 studs being more heavy duty?
Well, yeah, and it was a different bolt pattern. It was 6 on 5.5 as opposed to 5 on 4.5, I believe, is the smaller, later one.
And as we all know, if you listen to any of our shows, any of those 60s torsion axles are probably going to be needing replacement.
They're done. They're all done.
Yep.
From that era.
Yep. The rubber, it gets hard and doesn't respond anymore?
Well, that's part of it. I mean, rubber or plastics technology has gone great guns in 40, 50 years. And, just time, sitting on the thing compressed over a long period of time, sure, they sag out. Plus, as Fred was saying, the spindle issue, where they would fatigue and crack.
So the 60s era brought us the DuraTorque axles, which gave us independent suspension and the ability to drive with a wheel off if needed to chase down a spare.
On a tandem trailer.
On a tandem trailer.
It's a little trickier on a single axle.
Yeah, exactly. So what other updates did the 60s bring?
Well, in 64 was kind of a watershed year. They got away from the 7-panel end caps in 64, went to 5 panels. It was 64 was the last year for the door within a door. That had been an Airstream feature since 1947.
Which I think is a great feature.
Yes, I do too. And it's the first year for the Univolt, where all the lights and motors were wired together in one circuit, as opposed to having separate circuits for 120-volt and 12-volt lights, which they used in the early 60s.
So that brings about the modern era of trailer wiring.
Yeah, it simplifies things. It makes it a little easier to upgrade 12-volt appliances or lights and and so forth. And I think for any of the 60s, you're better off putting in a modern battery charger and rectifier to convert the 120 to the 12 volts. In 64, they just used an AC transformer, and they ran the motors on 18.5 volts AC. And in 65, they added a rectifier to have DC, and then in 66, they added a battery charger to it, but it was all pretty rudimentary stuff, and their modern electronics are just far better.
Did you have something to add, Rob?
I was just going to say that I agree with Fred on updating the electrics with, you know, taking the Univolt and putting in a new battery charger and new battery power as well.
And more battery power.
And that's right. We went with two AGMs on the Sovereign. We went, you know, all new, of course, and that's what Colin's doing too as well.
Yeah.
That's good.
So yeah, that loss of the door and the door, I think, is a big loss. I wish Airstream would bring back, but of course that's a lot more labor and many more parts they have to worry about, as well as seals.
Yeah, it's more hinges.
More hinges, more chance of leaks and stuff like that. So I understand why. Cost savings, it's easier to make a solid door, but that door and the door is neat. Now, on the 65 Caravelle we got, that's the year after they stopped the door and the door. We've got the Jealousy window in the door, which is kind of neat. We've also got the jeweled lights, little lenses that if you got the scare light outside on, the jewel on the inside of the trailer glows nice bright green. Pretty neat touch.
Oh, that's a cool feature.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Got the matching jewel over the stove when you got the light over the stovetop on as well. One's red, one's green. Pretty neat.
Another thing that listeners should be aware of with the early 60 trailers is that up through 1962, Airstream still built a park model that operated basically on 120-volt electrics. It would have an electric ice refrigerator. Wouldn't be wired separately for 12 volts, except maybe in an overhead ceiling light. But the other nice thing is you can identify a trailer much easier simply by looking at the serial number plate. Up through 62, if it says Airstream only on the serial number plate, it's going to be 120-volt kind of a park model trailer. If it says Land Yacht or International, then it's a self-contained trailer. In 63, they dropped the park model trailer, or the standard, and every trailer from 63 forward was self-contained, either a Land Yacht or an International, which was just a difference in trim level and a few features.
Fred,
so
the
serial number plate will tell people a lot about how their trailer was built and wired.
Can you describe what a park model would be?
Basically 120-volt appliances, electric water heater, electric refrigerator. It would be very difficult to boondock in that without doing a lot of upgrading. A Land Yacht or an International came from the factory with propane appliances. They'll probably need to be replaced if they haven't been in the past 50 years, but the delivery systems are there for getting the propane in, and so they were designed to be more self-contained.
Yeah, and I would say if you're replacing your appliances, replace the propane lines too, because when I took mine off, a bunch of black gook, I mean some really slimy stuff poured out of the lines. It was nasty.
We've found also that, strange it may seem, much like the water lines, they would end up getting water in them over time if there's no propane tanks on them. And we've seen them where they split just like the inside water lines do.
Oh, really? Wow.
So literally propane lines split underneath the trailer, even though it never officially had any water in it. So people should really watch that, because it's you could potentially have a bomb going on.
Yeah, I had that in the 65 Caravelle. They didn't have propane tanks on it when I bought it. And when I went and hooked up the propane lines and testing for the hot water heater, like, man, why isn't this lighting? And then I'm like, I can smell gas. And so I turned the gas off, and I looked, got onto the trailer and went right down the line foot by foot, and I found a big, long gash, just like Colin's talking about. No, I wasn't looking with my match. That's good.
You learned after that first time.
But you're right. You got to check that on these trailers when you find them, because you could have a little gash that's letting propane out. You know, I swear, I've been at rallies before and where you smell propane, and sometimes you wonder.
The other thing that we found is all of the fittings on the propane lines. You know, there's all these T's, flared fittings and stuff. All the nuts for the flared fittings are cracked, and that's again from freezing.
Oh yeah. Moisture. I wouldn't
have thought to check the nuts, but that's a good idea.
No, we found it by accident, and then we're going like, oh my god, look at this. And you started checking the rest of them. We had a whole gang of them like that. So now we check all of them, because it's really surprising how bad that system can go. Because of course the propane line is quite high at the end where the tanks are, and if any water gets in there, obviously it's going to travel down. There's no drain for it. It's, you know, being a propane system, so it's literally everything is low.
Yeah, and the smelling of propane on our 71 Safari when we were out, I think it was the second or third time, we smelled a lot of propane smell around our campsite, and we called up to the front desk there to have them come out and help us locate the problem. And of course, they see my old trailer; it wasn't polished or anything, and they start smelling around mine. I'm like, it's not me. And turns out the people in the motorhome across the way had their batteries boiling to the point where they were spitting out sulfur, and they had a bad charger and a bad bank of batteries, and the battery was hot to the touch until we got the battery cable off. The poor lady, she was there with her kids, so a bunch of people jumped in and helped out. So these old trailers aren't always the source of the weird smells, but sometimes they are.
I was going to say, Tim, usually the skunk smells his own hole first.
Yeah. That's what the park guy thought when he looked.
So Fred.
Yeah.
Tim was probably just looking for a free propane line or something.
That's right.
I was gonna ask, since Wally passed on in July of 62, was
it? Yes.
Yeah, yep. Okay. So how far up, maybe a 63, 64, still had some the Wally pieces in it before, you know, you could really say that Wally still had his hand in my trailer as it was made, and then it went to the Costello, and when we get later on in the 60s, of course, the Beatrice years, so... Mm-hmm.
I'd say through 63 shows a lot of Wally's design and influence in them. They had the same shell. They fixed up the interior is what Art could do with it. Put in closed overhead cabinet doors up front in 63, and you know, some custom lights that would have two fixtures in them, although they were kind of square and bulky looking. But when they went to the 5-panel end caps and rewired the trailer so the lights and motors were 12 volts and 64, that's when I think you first begin to see Art's influence showing up in the actual products.
They really started to lose a lot of Wally's direction.
Yeah, I think they did.
Well, what was different about Wally's viewpoint than the later years?
Ounces makes pounds.
Yeah, that's the key, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, although in the early 60s, they substituted a lot of plastic and fiberglass parts into trailers to reduce weight. And even though the trailers may have slowly crept up in overall weight, a lot of the individual components reduced weight. Like the bathrooms in 63 tended to be full width with a metal sink and a wood...
vanity?
Yeah, vanity for it and stuff like that. But in 64, they went to the airline fiberglass bathroom where the sink was molded into fiberglass. And so they lost a lot of weight in the bathroom by simply using a new material back there. They also shrunk it two-thirds and put a bunch of closets in for more storage.
They were thermoform parts later on.
Mm-hmm. Is it fair? Sorry, Colin. Go ahead.
I think it was right through 65 that they were still fiberglass. And they looked very similar in 66 where they went to the thermoform parts, which were quite light. Fiberglass, you know, is light to some degree, but certainly when they mold it all in one piece, you can incorporate cabinetry and sink and tub all in the same molding.
Yeah, and that was a quest to lighten a lot of the components of the trailer. On the other hand, they put a little more fashion in it. I think starting in 66, they had two different types of woods, one for a land yacht and one for an international, to further distinguish the trailers for marketing purposes. And the land yachts would tend to use an ash or a light wood, and the internationals would use walnut or cherry, sort of a dark, richer wood. And they also had more exterior badging in the late 60s to distinguish the international trailers. And I think one of the reasons is so salesmen could show customers, well, here are a lot of visible differences you see in the trailers. They're a little more fashionable. And so step up the sales from a land yacht to a higher profit model.
Is it fair to say Wally was more of the boondocker and Art was more of the resort camper?
Yeah, in a sense. I mean, Wally was right out there on the edge. If they had him on TV today, he'd have a show called Extreme Camping. You know, he was out pushing the limits.
At this point, he'd need an extreme makeover.
Yeah, that's true.
With all these reality shows, he'd probably make a good one.
Yeah, but Art was always more fashion conscious. It's interesting to look at the 60s photos of Art Costello, he's always a very natty dresser, and compare him to Wally with his eclectic style of wardrobe selection.
Yeah, Wally was always in his boots, and yeah, Art was always in his suit.
Yes.
Hey, what was the advertising like for the 60s? What kind of ads do we see now?
Well, they got more sophisticated. They started using a lot of the color photography from Ardeen Miller and putting it into brochures called the Airstream Story. And they started pushing the fashion features and doing lifestyle advertising. They didn't focus as much on the features of the trailer and the individual components as much as what the trailer could do to improve your life. So it was a little shift in the emphasis on the advertising.
And user's manuals started coming about too.
Yes.
The other piece I was going to say, I remembered what I was going to talk about, was this was really where many more people were getting into trailering as well, the 60s decade,
mm-hmm.
compared to the 50s. You saw a bunch more, a much larger contingent going out on the road adventuring.
There were baby boomers, Rob.
Right.
Yeah, and in the 60s, you saw many more women appear in the catalogs, and the trailers were depicted more as fashion items. In the late 60s, the bathrooms got very fancy. They had Hollywood mirrors with little bulbs around them and things like that. So they were selling convenience and comfort to women much more than in the 50s, which you just didn't see women that much in the sales literature.
So they were kind of selling a lifestyle instead of a trailer.
Yeah.
Now, do you think that helped build this iconic view that we have of the Airstream trailer now?
I think it did. What they were extending was Wally's idea that you could camp anywhere. That was Wally's idea with the international trailers in the late 50s that were self-contained. And in the 60s, they pushed that concept, but more toward a luxury end of the spectrum than simply a functional one. You know, you look at 66 when they introduced the frameless Corning windows and how they smoothed up the appearance of the trailers and the outside, you know, and gave it a very sleek look.
Also on the inside, they vinyl coated the aluminum skin instead of the Zolotone, which I think was also used in the aircraft interiors of the day.
Yeah, it was modern. I mean, today we look at vinyl, and our reaction wasn't the same as somebody in the 60s, because that was the cutting edge of modernity, was to have vinyl on walls. Aircraft were some of the leading edge design back then.
So what other what is there any leap in the appliances of the 50s to the 60s that made a big difference in the comfort?
Well, not really. They pretty much had the appliances sorted out by the early 60s as far as a propane water heater to provide water anywhere, nice propane stoves and ovens, the interior heaters. Well, they vented them out the sides instead of the roof, so they didn't take up as much space, and you avoided another hole on the roof with potential leaks. But the refrigerators weren't very big in the 60s. They tended to be under-the-counter fridges for a lot of times. So they had conveniences, but it was more the appointments that kind of went a little high fashion toward the end of the 60s.
And this is your favorite, Tim. They went from 2-inch to 2 5/16.
For the hitch.
that was in 69, though.
Yeah, but it still was in the 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, now, they had good ideas to modernize stuff.
Yeah. Colin, have you come across many problems or concerns with the wiring in the late 60s when you come up against aluminum wiring in the trailers?
Well, we've actually found wiring issues in all of them, whether it was copper or aluminum.
Okay.
Every single trailer you pull the inside skin off, you can see an issue that shows up that you'd bet that the owners of these trailers 30, 40 years ago were cursing for one reason or another on why things were intermittent or why a certain item didn't work. And, you know, it can come from literally in the early 50s, where they didn't put any anti-chafing on the 12-volt wires running through the walls, and they chafe through and short-circuit. But on the AC system, we found connections, even though all the connections are done behind a light fixture or a junction box or something like that, they would be arcing onto the skin occasionally, and we found burn marks in the inside the walls and ceilings and whatnot. In terms of the aluminum wiring, which I think was part of 67 and definitely 68, but we haven't seen it any other time. When we're tearing these trailers apart, if we've taken the inside skins out, we, you know, try and convince the owners that maybe now is the time to go to copper wiring. But if we're not totally disassembling it, you know, we suggest it. But unless there's a real reason to go that far, you know, it's worked for 40 years, but I'm a little hesitant about the aluminum wiring myself, simply because all of the sockets, et cetera, weren't really designed for it at the time. And I know you can retrofit in the new ones, but even those ones, I question.
On the 67 Tradewind that I had, all the sockets, you know, I took the sockets apart to check on the aluminum wiring, and they were all blackened and scorched where you could see where they were getting hot. And a lot of the wires, a good 2-3 inches up into the walls, the actual wiring plastic rubber coating of the wire was actually hard and brittle. If you touched it, it just dissolved and fell off. So I'm with Colin. I'd replace that wiring when you get going and get to that point where you've got the skins out. It's a good thing to do.
The other thing, that whether it's copper or aluminum, the earlier 60s, they didn't have a ground wire. And that's the other thing. When you're gutting something right back to nothing, you put in the modern two wire with a ground. And of, you know, just get rid of all the old crap, whether it was copper or aluminum. That way, you bring it up to the modern spec.
Right,
Colin. How are the replacement Corning glass windows working out? Have you had any experience with those?
Yeah, we've installed a bunch of them. The thing is, Vintage Trailer Supply, they had them remade, and they're actually the original thickness of glass is no longer available, or it's very, very expensive to get. So they had them made slightly thicker. So they are actually a lot tougher, a lot more robust than the original ones. Now, the original ones were tempered, but they were, if you have a good look at an original one, it says chemically tempered. It's a little different than being tempered with heat. The original ones also had a tendency to, shatter just sitting there. They wouldn't necessarily have to fall out of their hinge or even get hit by anything. They just explode into a million pieces just on their own.
Yeah, I've had that happen to a friend out here.
Yeah, it's not uncommon. We've had it happen here. We've had a lot of customers that have said exactly the same thing. One thing I can say is that getting the modern glass into the old hinge extrusion is difficult. Between 66 and 68, strange it may seem, they used three different hinge configurations, and only one of the hinge configurations actually allows you to open up around the glass itself. The two earlier ones actually had a extruded groove that the glass fitted into.
Mm-hmm.
The adhesive they used wasn't very good, or maybe it was good for 30 or 40 years, and then it died. We use automotive windshield urethane to bond them in. You end up having to remachine the groove to fit the new glass in. It's a bit of a production, but I think it's you end up with a much better window in the end.
Hopefully good for another 40 years, huh?
Yeah, and hopefully you won't have the spontaneous explosions that they have with
exactly.
The original glasses.
And the curvature is correct as well, which the plastic ones, you know, there's a lot of people keep saying, oh yeah, the plastic ones are great. That's, I think the people that are saying that are the ones that don't have to use them. Because basically, you know, the window, I think when it's closed, it's probably adequate. But when it's open, it flaps. And when you try to close it, you need somebody on the outside to push in on the glass to get those hooks to grab before you can actually crank the bottom of the window in. So it's a two-person job to actually close a window.
Yeah.
What about door handles? Anything from a? I know our 65 Caravelle's got like almost a regular household door knob, but I guess our 67 Tradewind had the same.
The early ones, I think they were called a Chesler lock, which I believe is no longer made. They were actually a much better quality than the replacement. Although the nice thing about the replacement is that they're not very expensive, they're readily available, and they fit right in without any modifications to the door itself. And that's a Bargeman L100 model, or an L200, which I believe the L200 has the not a round knob on the inside, but a lever. And there's also a long striker or a short striker. And the long striker came about when the doors became cast. The frame itself was cast. And that was, I guess, in 64, they still had short strikers. And then 65, they went to the cast door frame. And they had to make a very thick casting in the area, of course, where they put the striker through, which is obviously punching a large hole in a narrow beam is not the best thing structurally. So they made that casting very thick in that area, and in order to do that, they had to offset the door handle back a little bit and then recast a longer striker to fit in there to actually travel the distance they needed.
Also, in the after post 65, I think it was the Astrodome changed to style, as well as the air vents changed, didn't they?
Yeah, it was actually later than 65. I think 67. They still, I believe they had still had the square cornered air vents, but they went into the large radius astrodomes. And then by 68, they'd gone to the rounded or large radius 14 by 14 vents along with the large radius astrodomes.
Okay, before we started, Fred, you mentioned that we should stop at the 69 year. What happened between 68 and 69?
Well, in 69, Airstream introduced a completely new trailer body that was wider at the Beltline than any other place. It was something they had been working on for a couple years with outside design firms to just redesign the whole trailer. So there are a tremendous amount of changes beginning in 69 and going forward through the years. So 68 is really the last year for the 1960s trailer, and the 69 is nearly identical to the 70s and later trailer. So it falls into that category. It
still has that square window in the back. That's how you can tell 69.
And the square front wing windows. Or square corner.
On the bottom, okay. Yep.
Most people attribute the 69 and later models as the quote-unquote Beatrice years. However, in reality, Beatrice bought the company I believe it was late 67. Or actually, I guess negotiations started in early 67, and it was actually signed in late 67. So a lot of people at like to say they've got a 68 trailer that's not a Beatrice trailer, which quite frankly is I don't think is a detriment, but anyway, some people do. In reality, the 68 trailers are also Beatrice year trailers.
Right. Okay, well, that about takes up our time. We will pick up on, 69 and then the 70s on the next one, huh?
Groovy, man.
Have to break out the bell bottoms for that.
Yeah, that's right. Have to find some disco music, Tim, and that'll be our intro.
There you go.
I don't know what you got for the intro for the 60s.
Now you're going to make me work, huh?
Get Andy Gibb to come on. Maybe he wants one.
There you go.
Don't forget Flower Power.
That's right.
The Dean Martin Show, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm surprised more Airstreams from the 60s weren't actually painted.
Yeah, that's true, huh?
All the Flower Power stuff, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
They saved it for the Volkswagen vans, I guess.
That's right.
took far less paint.
Yeah. Plus it stuck better.
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty, guys. I want to thank Fred for coming on again. His input and knowledge on the Airstream history makes it extremely interesting for us, and I appreciate his time.
Always my pleasure.
And, of course, Rob and Colin on this day after Turkey Day for taking the time out to be here. Appreciate it.
That's nice being
here. Right. Yeah, thanks, Fred, and happy Thanksgiving, belated Thanksgiving to everybody.
There you go. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, guys, once again, appreciate it, and we will call the show.
Good night, all.
All right, take it easy.
Good night, everybody.
I lost my train of thought where I was going to go. It'll come back to me.
We can bleep that out.
If you want to get in contact with us here at the VAP Podcast, you can call the voicemail hotline at 206-202-4VAP. And the email address is questions@thevap.com.
The VAP, the podcast cool kids go for.